Succession number 27229, Reel 3.
Bob Jones, Reel 3.
Yeah.
So, from Implacable, you were drafted to?
To the Met course, Greenwich, which was September to Christmas. Another very intensive. I think pre-war it used to be a year, but, you know, the wartime, you do it, squash it in. Enjoyed it very much. It's a wonderful place, the Royal Naval College, of course, to work in. And, of course, we dined in the painted hall, served by wrens in white gloves. And not fair, is it, really? But the only little drawback was, of course, that when I got there, the V1s were in full swing. And the V2s started just after we started the course. So every now and then, of course, there would be a buzz bomb going over, and we'd all sort of put your pens down for a minute while you find whether it cut out or not. And of course, the V2s, if you heard them, they'd come, they'd gone, you know, because you never heard them coming. You didn't hear them till after they'd gone off. So if you heard it go off, you knew you weren't on the list. And I suppose you were on the list, you didn't hear anything anyway. We did have a couple quite near the college, just outside Greenwich. One when I was coming back from leave on a Sunday night, and got caught up in the diversions and so on, which was a nasty mess. But otherwise, we got through. One thing I found there, in fact, I'd found it in my initial course at in Bristol. I had not gone away to university. I'd gone straight from school and living at home, and it was rather like just going on with school and doing homeworks and things like that. I didn't really feel that I'd ever managed to work independently somehow. And I found at Bristol, I would go to my room. It was a college hall anyway, really, which I'd never been to as an undergraduate. But I had my room, and I could do my work and revise what I was doing and write my notes. At Greenwich, I'd go back to my cabin, as it was called, and I would do all my notes and so on. And I learned to study properly in the Navy, which I don't think I ever quite did. I was always just sort of kind of doing homeworks and writing up lectures in university. I learned to actually somehow study. I can't describe it exactly, but perhaps I was just that much older. And I often thought I might have done a bit better at the university if I'd been a bit older, but there's what. But it was an interesting experience. And at the end of the course, I came top in the med course out of about 30. So with 96%, apparently, I got a letter from the director of deputy director of Naval Meteorology congratulating me. And so that was rather nice. And I found it fascinating subject.
Can you give me an idea of what you were studying and how the course was
on? The meteorology. Well, we had lectures every day, but we spent much of our time, most of the afternoons, drawing, plotting weather charts from observations, not current observations, of course, historic ones, which we were supplied with. We would plot the chart, and then you had to draw all the isobars and find out where the lows and the highs were and where the fronts were, and then you had to make your forecast, and then they would give you the next chart and to see whether your forecast was all right, whether you had moved it on properly. But we did a lot of that, and I suppose one of my memories I always carry with me is towards the end of the course, or maybe it was the end of the course, I can't remember now, but we were all sent away separately to the naval air stations to have a week in the a real Met office. And I was sent to down to It's the fighter, the well-known place where the Fleet Air Arm Museum is down.
Yeovilton.
Yes. It was a fighter training place. So I report on Monday morning in the Met Office to the Met Officer. So, oh, he said, right. He said, well, I'd like you to forecast for a flight from here to Leon Solent and back today. So I said, all right, I got the chart and I sort of surveyed it all. And so I wrote it out, said I'd be about three-tenths cloud, cumulus cloud at about 2,500 feet, wind this, and so on, probably slightly bumpy condition, flying conditions. So he said, okay, he says, you're going. And so I had my first flight. And it came in a bit of a shock. And it was just some sub-lieutenant who was going on an errand to Lee, having lunch there and flying back. So I got in this thing, which was about as big as a mini with a couple of arms outside. And so we took off. And I'd never, well, like almost everybody in those days outside the Air Force, I'd never been off the ground. And so we flew up, and I'd said, well, about these bumpy clouds, because if you get cumulus clouds like this, they're only there because there's an updraft coming into them, outside them. So we said, OK, let's fly through a few. So we flew through these clouds, and as you went in, you went up, and then as you came out, you came down again. It was quite nice. I remember getting to Leon Solent, looking down at the airfield, I thought, how the hell are we going to get down there? You know, well, we made it and we came back. But it's always, I've always remembered this as my first forecast that I ever did about a flight, and I had to go on the bloody flight, you see. So it was fair enough. And of course, at the end of the course, I get a letter to say Belfast.
Can I ask about that? Did you have to learn about, obviously, the different types of clouds and their characteristics?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, it was quite an intensive course. And all the theory, thermodynamic theories of air systems and, you know, what happens if air rises and it's got this humidity and that humidity and... It was very intensive. The only thing you can say about it was that it was about four-fifths, if not nine-tenths, I don't know, about the Western Atlantic and the home waters. And, of course, I was posted to a ship that was going to the Pacific, which was a bit different. But that's one of those things. But I enjoyed the course very much. And as I say, I came out top and I presumably acquired a little bit more reputation, I suppose, in the education department. So whether Belfast was regarded as a nice surprise, a nice prize appointment, it was a good one anyway.
So where were you drafted to Belfast?
At the end of the Met course, which was... I joined her, I think... I could check it up, but I think it was probably about the 29th of December. And the reason I say that was that I got on the train, and she was in the docks at in the middle of a big refit in South Shields. So I got on the train from Birmingham to Newcastle, and then on the electric train to South Shields, and went and got a taxi to the docks, and. Got on board and reported to the captain, sir, and they said, oh, well, that's very nice to have you. He said that, I mean, it's nearly the new year, you'd like to hop off back home for the new year. So he said, I went virtually, unpacked a few things and got my cabin and then went back on the train to the family for the new year, which was the first nice gesture from my captain. That's why I say about the 29th. I'd only been there, and he said, well, you know, not much to do at the moment. Hop on home for the new year. So it was just like that.
What were your initial impressions of the ship when you saw her?
Oh, well, it was in dry dock. Difficult to say, really. It was covered in ropes and tackle and you know, in the middle of a refit. And there's junk everywhere. You're stepping over things all the time. And all the dockyard blokes and workmen and so on. And it really is a kind of obstacle course. It wasn't my first year, as I say, I've been in the Implacable, but the Implacable was virtually complete, you know, within a week or so of leaving the dock. Belfast had another 3 months to go, so it was a very long refit. Of course, she was being tropicalised, as they say. She was being fitted out to service in the tropics with lots of extra ventilation, trunking and all that sort of thing. Stacks of new armaments, because in the Pacific you were as likely to be done by kamikaze bombers as anything, so you need to be able to shoot down planes 100 yards away. And so she has a tremendous amount of new anti-aircraft stuff, heavy and light stuff, and as I say, and a tremendous new radar stuff, an operations room, special operations room down below with all the radar screens and everything, with an officer in charge of that. And so it was a very big refit, and it went on, and I suppose I didn't have a hell of a lot to do, but I went on a number of courses. I was sent on a number of courses. One was very important to me, it turned out, because it was we were getting toward the, it was pretty obvious we were going to win this one in this end, and they were concerned about post-war reconstruction and so on, and so they'd started this great program of current affairs in the services, really with the Army about this, and they'd set up the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, ABCA. And they were training all sorts of blokes to organise current affairs in the Army. And the Navy thought, well, we'll have to do something. So they set up a one-week course down in Blackheath, a residential week, run actually by the instructor captain who'd been in command of my initial course at Bristol. He'd gone and run this thing. So he was a bit of a Tartar in his way, but he ran this course, and I went on. I was sent on this, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating. We learned how to run discussion groups, techniques of running discussion groups. We had lectures on current affairs. We had the First Lord of the Admiralty come down and lecture to us, and some quite important people came down from London and gave us lectures, and we were told the whole framework of this business of getting people concerned about current events. I think they didn't want a revolution when the war finished, and wanted some thinking people around, you know. But it made a big impression on me, and I thought, I think this is very important. It's got to do something about this. And in the end I did, and but that had to wait.
Could you just tell me there, what is the technique for getting a discussion group?
I've got a booklet on it they gave me, I've still got it. Oh, it's a matter of sitting there and trying to draw everybody in. And if there's a silent bloke, trying to find a way of getting him to open up. And trying to shut up somebody who's trying to dominate the group. There's a lot of little bits like that. And you have to know what you're trying to do at the end, what you're hoping to do at the end. And you need to have a kind of set of a strategy or a tactics for getting it going. I can give you an illustration of one I used a lot of times later. And you have to look at this in the context of the 1940s. And I would go around and ask each chap to say, how many brothers and sisters did you have? And with you, that was how many children? And we go around and we tot it up. And then we go around and say, how many brothers and sisters did your father have? And tot that up. And it always came out about two or three times as many. And you say, that's interesting. I wonder why that is. And you get around to birth control and population explosions and all sorts of things like that. But it was a trick of setting it off, you know. And it used to work, actually. It wouldn't work now, I expect.
So he was using it in a sense of engaging them in a kind of personal way, with it being non-personal in a sense.
That's right, yes. It wasn't so personal. I mean, there's no shame in having several brothers and sisters, or no one or two or whatever. That wouldn't touch people's pride at all. Or even with their parents. It's a fairly neutral thing, and yet once you've sort of said that, oh, look at that, you know, that's interesting, I wonder why that is, you know, and then people...
And would you use open-ended questions?
Would?
You use open-ended questions? Who, what, how, why, how?
Oh, yes, well, you wouldn't, again, you wouldn't address it personally. But you'd say, well, I wonder why you think that is, and what are the factors, and so on, and... well, in the old days, they didn't know what to do, sort of thing. And I don't know, but you could slurt it, gradually then channel it into a thing of what's the future for populations, you see. And that's just an example of something you've got to think it out beforehand a bit. I couldn't summon up many others at the moment, but that's the sort of thing which, you know, we were told about. And so I determined that I was going to try and do something about that, and I did. But whether that might come a bit later, perhaps.
So, as the ship was refitting, you went on these courses. When you returned and the ship was ready to go, was the ship's full complement involved, or were they joining all the time?
They were trickling in as time went on. People were gradually being appointed, because obviously I think some people weren't needed until a bit nearer the time. But it was difficult to be sure. I mean, you arrive there, you don't know who's who for this, to begin with. I suppose that little bit of experience in the implacable with a more senior man in my own branch. As a kind of father confessor thing, was a nice way in somehow. I wasn't on my own as I might have been otherwise. I had a funny experience with the implacable. Well, I don't know if you ought to put this on record, really, but we used to have to do the censoring of the mail from all the sailors. And every morning you'd take a turn after breakfast, and they'd have sacks of letters all down the table, so you'd take your share, and you'd have to read them through and sort of cut anything out that shouldn't be in, and then seal it up and put it. And it was, it was quite boring. You'd think at one time it would be exciting, but it wasn't really. But one day I picked up a letter from a chap to a miss somebody something, and it said, "My darling," whatever it was, "thank you for typing out for me the words of our song, underlined our song. I keep it next to my heart all the time to think of you, or loving so and so." And this was Miss somebody in, say, Portsmouth or so. And then I thought, well, I put that down, picked up the next letter, with the same handwriting, to a Miss somebody else in Newcastle or something. And I said, "My darling somebody else, I have typed out for you the words of our song underlined, and I enclose them for you, and I hope you'll keep them next to your heart, your loving so-and-so." I thought, you cunning bugger. And I was so tempted to swap those two letters around, and of course I knew it was a grave error to have done that, so it went off, and I never knew what happened. And every time I've told this story, sometimes in company, I hope I haven't been sitting next to one of the ladies. a small chance, but nevertheless, there we are. So, yes. But I settled in quite happily. I was given a job of organising the officers' information room, which was a special cabin near the captain's cabin at the after end of the ship, which I would send all sorts of material. I had great big maps in there to show where the where the Allied armies had got to in Germany and where what was going on in the Pacific. I had all the pamphlets, you name it, and that was my job, and hardly anybody went in it. So I drew a cartoon one. You know those old Bateman cartoons? The man who did this. And so I drew a cartoon of the man who used the officer's information room was this little tiny officer about that high, slinking in like that, under the Marine sentry, who's looking down at him, sort of shamefacedly going into my information room. I put it on the wardroom notice board. But nobody minded very much. And a thing that affected me later started then because I had a little brush with the navigating officer, who was a lieutenant commander that had experienced. I think he'd been the navigating officer in the previous commission, actually. And I had my Met office in the superstructure, and I wanted a particular the workman to put a particular gadget in, a bracket in to hold my paragraph, and the navigating officer came and said he didn't want it there, he wanted somewhere else. And this was a problem for me because I was the Met officer and he wasn't. And as Met officer, I was responsible to the captain, not to the navigating officer. And we had a brush over this. And I can't honestly remember how it ended up. But we were never on good terms, which was a pity. Because, I mean, as far as teaching navigation to the midshipmen was concerned, that was my job. He gave them their practical stuff on the bridge, you know. And we didn't have much to do with each other, really, but it was an awkward brush, and it cropped up again later on in a rather amusing way, actually. But it did lead to a little problem a lot later on with the captain, with the only time I ever got told off by my captain. And
can I ask how, what you had in your Met office? What equipment you had?
In the Met office? Well, I had a barograph. There was a thermometer inside, and there was one outside, of course, which has to be protected from the sun. And wind direction and wind speed recorder with a pen on it, which showed the wind speed. And I don't think it was very much else than that. It opened directly onto the deck. It's just behind the second lot of guns. It's still there with the scuttle, but it's an office, somebody's office. It was locked up when I went last time. And I used to hang a fir cone and a piece of seaweed on the door handle with a note to say, if I was out, do your own forecast, you see. Well, I tend to look on the funny side of things, and nobody seemed to mind. But there wasn't very much equipment. Of course, you had to rely on reports coming in, mostly about weather. And once you were out of the UK and into the tropics or anywhere like that, there was bugger all coming in. And you had to rely very heavily on climatic information, which, fortunately, in some parts of the globe, you know what the weather's going to be like every day. Regardless, so, but you had to know when you were in a place like that and when not, and it was in fact very, very difficult. Whereas if I'd been in home waters, there would be reports coming in from ships, from aircraft, and so on. You get in the Pacific half as big as the whole rest of the earth nearly, and there was nobody about. You know, it's one bloody. You could hide a typhoon, you know, and nobody would know. It's anyway. That was ahead of me, that sort of thing. But of course, I wasn't exactly expert in that side of it. But I had to get the Met Office sorted out and the various publications, and had to start teaching the midshipmen once we got the midshipmen. And
how often would you teach them?
I can't honestly. I wish I could remember now. It would have been more than once a week. I had to put a blackboard up in the gun room, which was the midshipman's mess. There was no separate classroom or anything like that. So I'd go in and we'd teach them this, and then I would have to, I suppose they didn't come from the Admiralty or anything like that, I'd set the final tests and mark them and so on. And I had to keep a journal, instructor officer's journal, a big sort of foolscap thing, diary, you know, of all the things I did, which had to go to the captain twice a week to be initialled, and I expect all the other, what you might call, heads of departments. I've been a mini head of department, you see, because there was nobody over me for Met or for the education. So I had direct access to the captain, and very little to do with the commander, whereas many of the other people would report to the commander, or other heads of departments would be commanders usually, surgeon commander, engineer commander, paymaster commander, much senior to me, who would report to the captain. But I was a very junior boy, but he was very nice to me.
It's that interesting thing again, isn't it, about the instructional branch in a sense. You're slightly out of step with the other parts of the Navy.
That's right, yes. You're a kind of, there must be a word for it, kind of cuckoo in the nest in a way. No, that's not fair. The cuckoos check the other ones out, don't they? But you are you're a slight oddball. In fact, of course, one who's always known as schoolie. That's one thing. And in general, the instructor officers tended to be known as ex-chasers. Algebraically. Mm-hmm. The mathematics boys, you know. Doing sums. And I did get one nasty problem handed down from the Admiral later on, and I don't know whether I solved it or not, I've got the foggiest idea. But they had to tow some old dock, floating dock somewhere, with a long cable. And the problem was that part of the cable was in the water. Would be in the water, and therefore part of the cable was supported by the water and part of the cable was not supported by the water, and they wanted me to work out the tension in the cable. I invented my own solution, but I have no guarantee that it was right. But fortunately, a thing didn't break when it went. But that was the only time I got involved in a genuine mathematical problem for the ship.